Let's start with what's going on right now with this new rhetoric coming out of Europe, and they're talking about putting troops on the ground in Ukraine. Do you think they're serious? Are they gonna put troops in Ukraine and fight Russia, or it's part of their propaganda?
It's hard to tell. One thing I'm sure about is that it won't make any difference. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, as a joint armed force, is a complete joke. The Russians like to joke that the Estonians won't get to the battle if the freight elevator, the riding in, gets stuck. Their military is the size of a marching band. It just won't make any difference at all. It's just things that the politicians say because they think that the people, their minders in Washington, will like them better for it. One second. But that is not necessarily the case. I think it's just that they're running out of things to say. Now, Poland is the mad dog of Europe, and they're chomping at the bit. The politicians, that is, the people themselves, the previous times that there was talk of Polish non-mercenaries, there are always crazy people who want to fight, but the non-mercenaries being sent to the Ukraine, instead they drove for the German border. They're not going to fight, and they have EU passports, which means that they can sit it out in some other country until the politicians decide that maybe this was a bad idea after all. So there's a complete disconnect between the reality on the ground, which is anybody who wants to on the Ukrainian side can go there and get killed. And the Ukrainians are getting killed on the order of 1,400 of them a day at this point. But if there are some Europeans to kill too, then the Russians will be happy to do the honor. So it just means more dead people. That's all it means. But it doesn't mean any change of tactics or strategy or any big effect on the outcome.
Yeah, when you look at Macron, he recently said that he's gonna make a coalition in the European Union to train Ukrainians to fight Russia. And on the other hand, we've seen Boris Johnson invited Azov Battalion, and he was calling them heroes and let's give them whatever they need to fight Russia. When you see this sort of behavior on the part of European leaders, what's your take on them? What they're trying to do, in your opinion?
Well, you have to look at what the state that Washington is in right now. You have one president who is senile. You have another president in waiting who would win unless he's sent to jail beforehand. Neither of them is particularly interested in Europe at all. In fact, they would rather just basically have Europe go away. And so the Europeans are feeling like there ought to be a European leader there somewhere. They just don't know who that might be. I mean, if you look at Scholz, he's a not leader material, and his entire government, if you look at people like Baerbock, if you look at the other people there, Pistorius, they're a joke. They're not smart enough for Germany, never mind all of Europe. And so Manny Macron is about the only candidate that anybody can look at, except he's kind of a joke too. But they have to play this game of who's the leader anyway, because what else is there to do? It doesn't mean that they suddenly have some kind of a military might, or that they're in any position to train the Ukrainians, who've been fighting an actual war for 2 years and losing, but slowly, not all at once. whereas the Europeans would lose in about 2 weeks. So there's a big question as to who should be training whom. And I would say that the Ukrainians should be training the Europeans, not the other way around.
When you look at these new weapons that Russia is moving them to the Sumy region and what they're doing right now, in your opinion, what would be the reality of the battleground there? Are they trying to capture some sort of territories there, or they're still thinking of making a buffer zone there?
Well, from what I can tell, well, it's like this. Putin makes a public order to, as commander in chief, he says, do X. And he does it publicly. And the military says, yes, sir. And they go and they execute that order. It would look funny if they did something else that they weren't ordered to do, or if they didn't do what they were ordered to do. So what we should expect is them to establish a buffer zone big enough to suppress Ukrainian artillery and rocket attacks on Russian soil. And so that's what they're going to be doing. The other thing that Putin has told them to do is, first of all, no casualties. Just be very, very, very careful. We're conserving our troops because once the special military operation is over, there'll be political jobs for all these veterans. They'll be the new Russian elite, battle-tested, patriotic. And so it's very important that Russians don't accidentally die while executing this mission. And the other thing that Putin has said is that the important thing is to have enough firepower. So if this isn't working, then you probably aren't using enough firepower, and just shell them harder, send them more rockets, use everything you got. Basically, clear the area before you wander in there and make sure that there's nobody left. So the order of the battle now is Ukrainians hiding in holes and using drones and using what little artillery they have, but they're not really showing their heads above ground very much, making it very difficult to find where they are and flush them out. And so that's what's going on. That's why it's taking such a long time.
Yeah, a German newspaper said that Ukrainians gonna lose a lot of land by the end of this year. And do you think when they're talking about this, are they really considering that Ukraine gonna lose Odessa and Nikolaev soon?
Well, that is a political, not a military question. At some point, the Ukrainians are going to realize that they don't have a president anymore and that the government they have is unelected and that it's not really worth fighting given what's going on, and that they should probably just make peace with the Russians. Now, historically, the Ukrainians are very good at switching sides. They have done that many times throughout their history, and they can do it very, very quickly, so quickly that everyone can't even catch their breath. One moment you have this white Ukraine, and the next moment you have a red Ukraine, and what happened? Nobody knows. They all changed their mind, and they did it overnight. So that would be a political change that could happen at any moment. From what's going on inside the Ukraine right now, it's conceivable that it could happen because right now we basically have this corpse, political corpse of a nation being eaten away by worms that are sending all kinds of useful information to the Russians. The Russians have really excellent intelligence because the Ukrainians are very eager to earn brownie points, curry favor with the Russians because they know what's coming up next. They don't want to be perceived as the enemy when the Russians come in. They want to be recognized as the people who helped the Russians. So there are lots of people high-ranking officers within the Ukrainian military. There are lots of people just basically working jobs, maybe defense contractors, maybe some other function, but they're always sending information to the Russians. The Russians know what's going on the ground throughout the Ukraine, making it very easy for them to target anything that the West tries to do. So the West tries to bring in some new artillery shells. Those get blown up the moment they're stockpiled. Or the recent example that happened yesterday is the training and control center for F-16s that they built in a place called Yavorov. It's a firing range, which is funny because Yavor means I'm a thief. Kind of an interesting name, but it got blown up with the trainers, who a lot of them were Belgian or Dutch, and a lot of them had to be evacuated to Poland, to Germany, to Sweden, to various other places. Hundreds of casualties. So that is, first of all, it shows you that supplying F-16s to the Ukraine will not result in F-16s attacking Russia. It will end up with something or other being blown up the moment Russians hear about it, and they'll hear about it immediately. So that's basically the situation. It's coming apart politically. The question is how quickly and to what extent. The other thing to watch for is when the Ukrainians turn on their own. There's a lot of anger within the Ukrainian population, because a lot of people think that they've been lied to, and what they want to do is take revenge on the people who lied to them, who sent their children, their sons, to die for no good reason, who served foreign interests instead of serving the interests of the people themselves. And so there's a bit of a civil war brewing within the Ukraine itself. That would be very much to the Russian advantage. There is no chance that the Ukrainian military will be able to hold it together if there's a civil war going on in its rear. And if that happens, then the Russians could start creeping along maybe a little bit more confidently than they're doing now, which is basically two villages a day is the rate at which they're advancing now. There are thousands of villages in the Ukraine. At this rate, it could take a really long time.
Yeah. You talk about the situation right now in Ukraine. Do you see any sort of military coup happening in Ukraine? Because the situation that most of the people we had, Poroshenko was not happy with this continuation of Zelensky's term as the president of Ukraine. We have many political movements inside Ukraine, and but it doesn't seem that the West is totally taking care of these movements. How do you see the situation politically in Ukraine?
It's under remote control, but the remote control is broken because Washington is broken. So Zelensky is basically a Washington appointee. He was initially thrust into the limelight by an oligarch who is now in jail. But once he was in the limelight, the Americans liked the idea and promoted him. But Zelensky is over. His reign is over as of May 20th. He's now a squatter in his own office. Who would want to take his job? Well, Poroshenko is actually drunk enough to think that that's a good idea. The man starts his day with a rum and coke, I hear. That's what he has for breakfast. So I wouldn't be surprised if he thinks that becoming the president again of this failed state is a good plan. But this is really sloppy seconds. He already stole a whole bunch of money the first time around. There's a lot less to steal now, and there's a lot more risk. So why would he want to do it? And I can't hear of anybody else who really wants the job. Right now, according to the Constitution, the Speaker of Verkhovna Rada, their parliament, is supposed to be the stand-in for the president, but he doesn't seem that eager. He would rather have Zelensky to take the ball and get trampled. And so basically that's the political situation I see is Zelensky still has the ball and he's going to get trampled.
How long Washington is willing to keep him as the president of Ukraine? Do you think that after 2024 presidential election in the United States, they're gonna change him, or are they gonna keep him up until some sort of political settlements comes along?
Well, they have to survive that long, in order to be in a position to make any sort of a decision. They have many bigger problems to deal with, and in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they try to pretend that the Ukraine doesn't exist, because it basically won't be any help to anyone's career in Washington at this point, no matter what anyone does. And God forbid you make some ghastly mistake and you say, this guy is president, and then it turns out that he's Russian. That could very easily happen at this point in the Ukraine. And what a disaster that would be. Just imagine the Americans introduce the next stooge, and the next stooge flies to Moscow and shakes hands with Putin and, starts signing deals. That would be just too horrible to contemplate, and the Americans would be just powerless to stop it. They probably just want to leave the whole situation alone and hope that nothing bad happens at this point, or at least that nothing really bad happens until after the election. I think it's basically just a hot potato. Everybody knows that they've blown it. Nobody knows what to do about it. So best to just ignore it and concentrate on something else.
As you mentioned, Donald Trump may win. How do you see his policy? He recently said that if this conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in Taiwan had happened during his presidency, he would attack Beijing and Moscow. And do you think he's serious when he's saying something like this, or he's making some noises that just he's using this type of language just to satisfy those people who we call donors of Donald Trump?
I think it's simpler than that. I don't think it's even the donors. I think it's just the audience. He reads his audience pretty well. He's a showboat. He's a grandstander, and he gets carried away. So I wouldn't be surprised if he came up with that rhetoric on the spot. Now, this is American campaign rhetoric. And one thing that everybody needs to understand is that Americans never take their campaign promises seriously. Never. There's a saying that somebody's lying like they're running for office. So basically, that's what he's doing. Now, it's already pretty well known that what the president wants to do and what the Defense Department wants to do in the United States are at least two different things, maybe three. If the president wants to attack Beijing, that may mean that the Secretary of Defense gets on the phone to Beijing and says, "The idiot wanted us to bomb you," and they would laugh at each other, and that would be the end of it. Friendly chat, because they're not suicidal. The thing to understand about high-ranking military people is that they're all survivors to one extent or another, and survivors are not suicidal, and so they're not likely to push the wrong button at the wrong time. And so Putin, Putin, Trump saying that at a rally means absolutely nothing, absolutely nothing.
The president of Estonia recently said that we're going to bring Russia to its knees. It's so unbelievably ridiculous when you see something like this coming out of the mouth of a president of a country that is a tiny country that doesn't have the capabilities to do anything on the battlefield in Ukraine. And but still there it seems that they're trying to make noises in the European Union. Do you see that it's part of their policy And as the war is going on and the presidential election is going on in the United States, they're trying to do the best to make at least political tensions for the conflict between Russia and the West, just to let Joe Biden be so calm and doing his job in the presidential election in 2024.
Well, I mean, Estonia is a bigger subject than the country is, And they try to keep it that way. Their greatest fear is that everybody will simply forget that Estonia exists. They're very happy that they're in the European Union because if it wasn't for that, it would just be like some swamp to the southwest of St. Petersburg that nobody ever goes to. You have to understand that Estonia at this point has lots of deer, lots of bears, lots of wild boars, quite a bit of moose, and not too many people. And it's a small country. It's a small country with lots of wild animals. And then it has some rather foolish people whose And the best thing that has ever happened to them is they got invited into the European Union and NATO and get to go to all these conferences. But now people are not paying that much attention to them anymore. They're just not really interesting. And so their solution is to make even more noise. This doesn't always work out very well. For instance, Kaja Kallas, the prime minister of Estonia, was very interested in becoming the new General Secretary of NATO because she's a woman, you see. And it's about time there was a woman. There are all the it's fashionable to have Secretary of Defense in the European Union. That's how Ursula von der Leyen got a step up, wrecking Bundeswehr in Germany, but no secretary of NATO has been a woman yet. So she thought that that was a really good idea, and she made very belligerent noises towards Russia, to the point where the Russians basically issued an order for her arrest. So she's now a sought fugitive from Russian justice, which made NATO reconsider her candidacy because you don't really want a general secretary who is a fugitive from Russian justice. So that didn't work out very well. But she did say some funny things along the way. For instance, she said that Russia is too big and should be divided into lots of smaller countries. I did some math and it turns out that Estonia can be divided into 360. I mean, Russia can be divided into 360 Estonias, which is quite a lot of little countries. But that's definitely not happening. And then we'll put Russia on its knees. I mean, that begs the question, how? I mean, go on, please tell us, how are you going to put Russia on its knees? We're really just waiting for some details there. But this is just silliness. It really, the European Union and NATO now are working hard to maintain this circus atmosphere. It's a clown act. There is some serious psychological derangement there, but on the surface, it just looks like a clown act.
Dimitri, the other thing that Putin said recently, he was talking about the production of arm and ammunitions in Russia, and he said in some areas they were increased by 22 times, 15 times. It's so important what has happened during this conflict in Ukraine. Do you think the policy of the Russian army of the Putin, of Putin and his administration would be in the aftermath of this war, this conflict in Ukraine, would be just selling these weapons because this is a new industry for Russia, new field for Russia. And we know that in the past they were so hesitant to sell any sort of arms to to other countries like Iran, Turkey. They were so cautious about these things. Do you think that would change, this attitude on the part of Russia would change in the aftermath of this conflict or even right now?
I don't think so. I think that this is how Russia operates when there's a war. There are two components. One is the front, the other one is the rear. They're equally important, and both are part of the military. So the military-industrial complex, on that, unlike the United States and Europe, where it's private companies, this is basically different parts of the military, making weapons and using systems that are made. Using weapons are different sides of the same coin. And it no more means that Russia will up its weapon sale than it means that Russia will go on to fight lots of wars all over the globe. They're not interested in that. They're interested in ending this conflict and reestablishing peace. And once peace is reestablished, all of this new rejuvenated factory production will be directed towards civilian needs. It will be far more effective for Russia to take care of a larger share of heavy industry for China than to export that energy to China, and for China to then invest that energy in heavy industry production. Heavy industrial production, because energy is the largest component, and Russia has energy in abundance, and energy is best used where it's produced, which is right inside Russia. So I think that the fact that Belousov is now in charge of the defense industry, and he's an economist, I think that that has to do a lot with directing the thinking towards peace, because he's not a military man. And his task will be to quickly reorient the defense industry to civilian uses without missing a beat. That is really part of what he will try to do.
Right now in the United States, they're talking about fighting China and sending latest generations of weapons and ammunitions to Taiwan. Unlike Ukraine, they were sending old weapons and old ammunitions to Ukraine. And do you see any sort of escalation between China and the United States militarily in Taiwan?
Well, China has reached parity with the United States as far as the ability to deploy naval forces. The difference is that these naval forces, the Chinese naval forces, will be deployed right next to Chinese mainland and will have artillery support and rocket support right from the Chinese mainland. And the Americans will have to sail all the way across the world's biggest ocean to get there. They will be at a great disadvantage. The other thing is that, it doesn't matter how many weapons you give to the Taiwanese. The question is, will they really want to die to prevent political integration with mainland China? Or will they simply decide that they should perhaps take a reasonable offer? Which is to survive and sacrifice a bit of their autonomy. So right now, basically, there's a bankrupt regime in Taipei, paid for by the Americans. But the moment they stop being paid by the Americans, they will probably switch sides, because after all, they're Chinese. They understand that they're Chinese and that their future is with China, not with the United States. The other thing is that there's understanding in Taipei that they have one major selling point, which is that nobody in the world can make the fancy chips as well as they can. But they also understand that the Americans are trying to close that gap. They've been trying to build a factory to make those same chips in Arizona, without any luck, because the Americans are so terrible at building factories these days. But one of these years, they might succeed. And then suddenly they may decide that Taiwan is no longer interesting. And that, just like right now, they're deciding that Israel is no longer interesting. And there's not a single country in the world that has allied itself with the United States that the United States did not at some point abandon. The United States is very quick at abandoning its friends and allies. It's all about money. So the moment having a particular friend becomes becomes unprofitable, the Americans go for profit somewhere else.
Yeah. How do you see Philippines and what's going on in Philippines? Do you think that part of this conflict would be a proxy war using Philippines against China?
I have seen so far no evidence that the Philippines want to do, the Filipinos want to do anything other than take American money. They don't want to go and die fighting China. There might be a skirmish of some sort just to make sure that everybody knows that they exist and that they're important and their interests should be taken into account. But they will not, I don't think, launch or be part of an all-out attack on China. That just seems extremely not in their interest.
Many people are saying that what's going on in Georgia is just a distraction for Russia. They're trying to distract Russia from what's going on in Ukraine. And they're making a lot of noises in Georgia just to distract Russia. How do you see the situation right now in Georgia? How serious is that for Russia, in your opinion? And how important is this new law of foreign agents that was passed by the parliament, then vetoed by the president, like then after that, political parties are talking about just canceling the veto of the president, and a lot of difficulties right now in Georgia.
Well, first of all, a terrible thing happened from the West's point of view, which is the Georgians realized where their real interest is, which is in Russia. Most of the trade that Georgians have is with Russia. A lot of the tourists that they're getting are Russian. They can use the fact that they still, a lot of them, speak Russian to attract Russian tourists. And they now pretty clearly understand that this entire Western and American effort to turn to make them turn away from Russia was not in their interest. The Russians, they like the Georgians. There are a lot of Georgians living in within Russia. You know, there's some cultural affinity, there's a common history that goes back centuries. The Russians like Georgian cuisine. The Europeans and the Americans have no idea what the Georgian cuisine is. Georgian wines are very popular in Russia, but they don't travel very far. So they're sold in Russia, but they're not really exportable very far at all. And plus, in the West, nobody knows what Hvanchkara is. They would need a special seminar just to learn to pronounce the name, or Kindzmarauli. The Russians can just rattle it off, but when it comes to the Europeans or the Americans, forget it. You know, it's like an alien universe to them. So I think what's happening in Georgia now is that they finally realized what their national interest is. They've woken up to real to understand what's really going on. They understand that this Western influence, these Western NGOs, are basically ruining them and have decided to take a baby step away from the cliff. And the fact that there has been such an uproar and these NGOs are spending so much money trying to thwart this effort and not succeeding is just delightful. And so I don't think this is harmful to Russia. I think this is most entertaining and quite heartening because Russia is getting some of their friends back. One could only hope that things were going just as well in Armenia, which is in quite a bit of trouble, not really talked about as much, but That really has a really bad situation brewing. Armenia is really coming apart, whereas Georgia is coming back together, which is a good thing.
The other thing would be, how do you see this coalition, this type of economic coalition between Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, and this new project that they're thinking of? How do you find these new, because that would be huge in terms of their partnership. What's your take on this?
I think that this is a really amazing effort to circumvent a lot of bottlenecks. Bosphorus, Dardanelles, the Suez Canal, Gibraltar, and have direct access to the Indian Ocean, so that the Russian mainland and will be able to export energy and raw materials and manufactured goods directly to the Indian Ocean through Azerbaijan and Iran. And so that's a wonderful thing. It's a great project. Not that difficult and not that expensive. This is really just a question of upgrading rail and port facilities. So it's quite doable. It's a lot less money than spending money on the Trans-Siberian, which is the Russians are doing anyway, or the North Sea route, the Northern route, which is again very expensive. So this is a good, cheap project, and so if that happens, that would be just fantastic.
Yeah. And just shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, we've seen that Netanyahu and his administration are attacking Rafah. It's the situation is so dire and unbelievably, yeah, it's unbelievable what's going on right now in Rafah. And how do you see the current situation of the international community to convince the Israelis not to do that?
I think the Israelis are beyond convincing. I think that it's basically keep the battle going or go to jail. That's their choice. They've committed such ghastly crimes against humanity that there's really no way to wipe the slate clean or anything really. They're facing the entire Israeli establishment is facing political death, and so they're avoiding that death for as long as possible. But what's happening in America is that American Jews are losing interest in supporting Israel because Israel is becoming a liability for them. Now you have to understand that after World War II, Jews went to just two countries, largely, which is Israel and the United States. And the population is equally split between the two of them, which is why Israel has had such a strong run. It has had steady support from the Jews in the United States. But now everybody is discovering that Israel is quickly becoming a liability, not an asset. And furthermore, it was the idea that that Israel is this unsinkable aircraft carrier that the United States has in the Middle East and can use Israel to control the entire territory. Well, the recent action with Iran has proven that not to be the case. Israel is unable to defend itself and cannot really defend itself even with the help of the United States and the European Union and NATO. So the other thing is that if Israel cannot keep the trade routes open through the Suez Canal in particular, if it cannot allow American shipping through the Suez, then what use is it? And now it turns out that the Houthis can shut down the Suez Canal at will, and Israel can't do anything about it, making Israel quite useless. So the combination of all of these things means that Israel needs to go away. Maybe not immediately, but it eventually just needs to be dismantled because it no longer serves a purpose. It's no longer a safe haven for Jews. It's no longer an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the Americans. It can no longer preserve Pax Americana in the Middle East. So what does it do? What is it for? What is its purpose? It doesn't have one. Its only purpose now is to keep Bibi Netanyahu out of jail. That's it.
Yeah, one of the consequences of this conflict in Gaza was the position of Turkey as a NATO ally for the United States. They're changing their attitude toward Israel drastically. They cut everything. They cut all the exports from Turkey to Israel. If they stop sending this pipeline that goes from Azerbaijan, comes and through Turkey and goes to Israel, it's 40% of their energy, if I'm not mistaken. That's huge for the state of Israel. Do you think if they continue doing these actions, these type of atrocities in Gaza, in Rafah, do you think we're gonna get to a point that Turkey says no more energy to Israel? Is that possible in your opinion?
It is quite possible because Erdogan has to placate his own constituency that is the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is a Turkish project, and Hamas is very close to the Muslim Brotherhood. So, as the situation in Gaza unfolds, Erdogan is forced to take into consideration the feelings of his own Muslim Brotherhood constituency, which he has put a lot of effort into cultivating as Turkey's, if you will, soft power in the region. So that may force his hand at some point into saying, okay, no more trade with Israel. I'm not sure if there's any trade with Israel going on now, but I can definitely see Israel being cut off from this flow of energy.
Yeah. And how about the Arab nations? They didn't talk to Saudi Arabia, UAE. These countries didn't talk a lot about what's going on in Gaza so far. But we know that the public opinion is so totally against Israel. Do you think that at the end of the day, they're getting to the point that let's go consider the relationship with China and Russia and BRICS, that would be much more important for us. That's why we don't have to have any sort of fear of the United States anymore. Because part of this type of behavior on their part is this fear that they're gonna crush their economy and they're not interested in that confrontation.
I think that they're very interested in participating in BRICS. They're very interested in having productive and a close relationship with both China and Russia. They see that as the future. They see the United States as the past and to some extent the present. So they're not entirely interested in severing ties with the United States. They're willing to play both sides and find middle ground, but I think that there's less and less willingness to put up with the Americans given the recent bunch of political assassinations and political assassination attempts, which most people blame on Western British and American special services. There was a threat against Mohammed bin Salman. There was a threat of a coup against Recep Erdogan. Raisi, of course, died. And there was some other attempts as well at political assassination. That shows the extreme desperation of the West. You know, that is their last resort. Political assassinations. How low can you sink? But I think a lot of these Arab countries, they're not that big and that powerful. And they have a lot of foreigners working there. So they don't really want to end up on America's hit list. At least not immediately, maybe wait a few years until America and the West are sufficiently weakened. But right now, they're being careful.